You're listening to
Maine and Gray, the intersection of the city of God with the city of man, where we talk with interesting people doing interesting things out in God's world, and all for God's glory. The duck walked into the bar and he asked the second question. He asked if he had nails first, so that...
So the joke goes like this. It's a terrible joke, but a duck goes into a bar and he goes to the bartender. Bartender says, "What do you need?" He's like, "You got any duck food?" Mm-hmm. The bartender says, "No, it's a bar. We don't have any duck food. Get out of here." So he leaves. Next day he comes back, waddles up to the bar, says, "Hey, got any duck food?" Bartender's like, "No, I told you yesterday. We don't have any duck food. Get out of here." So the duck leaves. Third day comes in, walks up to the bar. "Got any duck food?" Bartender's getting mad now. He's like, "I told you the last 2 days, we don't have any duck food. You come back in here asking for duck food, I'm going to nail those little wet feet of yours to the floor." So the duck leaves. The fourth day, the duck comes in, waddles up. Bartender's already mad, but asks, "What do you want?" He's like, "Got any nails?" He's confused. And he's like, "No. You got any duck food?" It's bad.
That's good. It's not the worst dad joke.
Yeah, I mean, you laughed, and I know it was pity, but
yeah,
I'll take it.
Yeah, not pity, no. But I'm kind of on a tirade against dad jokes, so.
Okay, well, there you go. Yeah.
But that was good. It wasn't a pun. Like, to me, that's the lowest form of dad jokes.
The puns, yeah.
But I'm not that's very just
funny,
me.
So it's just wherever I heard a joke, and I thought it was funny.
I like it. All right. Can I interest you in some coffee?
I'm not a coffee drinker.
I know that, and I offered it to you anyway.
Yeah, so...
How did you escape that many years of grad school without drinking any coffee?
Yeah, I tell my students all the time, I was in college for 12 years. 12 years.
12 years.
Yeah, 12 years of college.
Yeah.
Four kids. All of them was while I was in grad school, I think. Never started coffee. And I figure if I can make it that far in life...
Right.
And I turned 40 in like 3 days.
Yeah.
So at this point, I don't think I'm going to be picking up coffee.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So maybe not now out of need, but any sense of enjoyment. Like, oh, maybe one of these flavored mocha latte frappolitti things would
maybe.
Be, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I like going to, I like the atmosphere of a coffee shop. Mm-hmm. I like to visit a coffee shop. I like the smell of coffee.
That's not interesting. But so I'm not going to convince you on the show to go ahead and drink some coffee.
Probably not. No.
So. Did you have a stimulant of choice then? Or was it, you know, to like share anything bad, but like 4-hour energy drinks or Monster Energy? You just didn't need it.
No.
You just powered
water
through.
And milk are pretty much all I drink anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, from a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, you don't need a...
Yeah, I don't.
Any caffeine.
Yeah, I don't do caffeine.
Yeah.
No, I like iced tea on occasion. So
sweet or unsweet?
Sweet tea. I was a farm boy, so we did a lot of sweet tea when I was a kid.
Yeah. So you're in the education field.
Yeah.
You are an educator, professional educator.
Correct.
By craft.
Yeah.
What do you do on a daily basis? You're director of a department, right?
My official title is program chair and associate professor, if you want to get real technical. So I have a teaching load and an administrative load. Mm-hmm. And I do a combination of overseeing all of our faculty. So we've got a full-time faculty partner. Who reports to me, some part-timers in any given semester. So I evaluate them, hire them, you know, check in on them. I'm their supervisor, so complaints, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And I'm responsible for the schedule. I sit on a curriculum committee, so we make decisions on what we're teaching, what are the course objectives. I oversee agreements with other colleges and universities. I work with K-12 educators when we... for student placement experiences, work and learn experiences, and we offer dual credit. So we also provide opportunities where I do some supervising and training and that kind of stuff.
So dual credit, do you actually have students that are still in high school?
On occasion. I don't very often. I had a sophomore.
Give that to others.
Yeah. I mean, well, the dual credit folks usually take that.
Right.
So, yeah, usually they're a group of high schoolers who are taking a college course collectively.
Right.
And because that teacher has the credentials to be a college faculty member, we basically give them the credit. So we oversee them, make sure the course is academically rigorous. We make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do. But we award the credit, and it's free to the student. So it just makes college a little more affordable.
That's cool. Yeah. So you're educating educators.
Yeah.
Future educators.
Yeah. Now, occasionally we get students who are going here for updating licensure. So on occasion we have students who are actually current teachers. It's usually in the summer, though.
Does that ever wake you up in the middle of the night like, oh, man, I'm teaching the future teachers of America. I am way out of my league. Not out of your league, like you're not shouldn't be doing this, but that's a heavy load to be thinking that I'm going to be shaping future educators, which means I'm shaping future students.
Yeah. I think I started this journey with that idea of just having an impact. So I remember the first, I used to be a kindergarten teacher, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was an elementary school teacher here in Indianapolis Public Schools and Warren Township, suburban schools. I remember the first kid coming up to me and he's like, or the first parent came up to me and was like, "You're my kid's teacher, right?" And that hit me pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I mean, I've seen that, but I've never had somebody address me that way. That was kind of hit. And then I had a, I think my first year as a faculty member at the college, I think somebody came up and said something like Buckle or Andrew or something like that. But they said it in a way that was not the common title I had at the college. And I realized I was talking to a former student when I was an elementary school teacher's parent, and that they were going to be in my class. So I taught both the parent and the child. So I taught two generations at one point.
Oh, interesting.
And so that was kind of interesting.
For just drawing near 40, that's pretty impressive that that happened.
Yeah. And now my first kindergarten class is in their early 20s, so I'm a little concerned that one of them is going to show up one day and be like,
I still can't read.
They either can't read or they're like, "You're the one that set me on this kind of path," or something.
Right.
So,
cool. So what do you think future educators are facing today? Or like, what are they, you've got a freshman or you got a senior in your education courses. Mm-hmm. They're about to embark on an education career. Mm-hmm. What's different today than it was for you back when you started as a kindergarten teacher?
Yeah.
Surely things have changed in, what is this, 20 years?
Yeah. Coming close to it now. Well, first, you know, I started the career being told, good luck finding a job, because we had a surplus of teachers, specifically in Indiana.
What year was that, give or take?
02?
Okay.
No, 07.
Yeah. That's when you were coming out of college, or PhD?
I guess 07. Yeah, 07 was coming out of college, undergrad.
Okay.
Yeah, 06, 07, somewhere in there.
Okay.
So we had a surplus of teachers then.
Hmm.
So that played a big variable. So there was this idea that you were training for something you weren't even going to get a job for.
Interesting.
Today, you know, schools and school systems are knocking down everyone's doors trying to say, "Hey, you got anybody ready to teach?"
Hmm.
So that's one is, who's in the driver's seat, who gets to negotiate and that kind of thing, which is exciting for our students, but then you start realizing why that negotiation is happening, why there's the need. And that comes to the bigger question is, I think culture in general has moved this way, and of course COVID didn't help it any. We started seeing what the teacher does or doesn't do in a virtual space. So some people thought, well, I can do that. You know, that's, you know, they should be upping their game or something like that. There was also some sympathy, right? You're watching a teacher who's trained to manage a classroom, manage an online environment, which is a completely different experience. And now you've got teachers, you know, the idea of like a snow day, for example, is no more or less, right? Mm-hmm. We're done with snow days. So now you've got teachers who are prepping and they're not sure, you know, especially come winter as we're approaching that now, right? They're not sure, am I going to have my students in class? Are they going to be out of class? So there's a lot of those kind of challenges, right? Just logistical things. Mm-hmm. We also have the idea of every student in your classroom being a general education student that doesn't have some sort of exceptionality is not really present anymore. We have all types of exceptionalities, learning disabilities. The autism spectrum continues to kind of change and morph. We certainly have other cognitive impairments, and then you wrap around students with mobility issues and things like that. Every classroom, if, you know, assuming they've got 25, 30 students in there, you can kind of envision and expect that there's a significant portion that's going to have some sort of individual educational plan. And that doesn't include just helicopter parents who already were trying to kind of, you know. And so, you know, you're listening to this and you're, as a teacher, you're sitting here saying, okay, all of that for what many will complain about being low pay, right? So beginning teacher, I push back on the low pay thing a little bit, and that doesn't even talk about the social issues, right? We've got, what kind of curriculum can and can't be talked about. We talk about racial, curriculum. We talk about LGBTQ curriculum. We talk about, gender identity and sexuality and those kind of things, which are often in the news, which show up in the classroom, and you have a host of people on the spectrum on whether they agree with these initiatives and not.
So, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. I want to
right.
Start. Yeah, I mean, that yeah. was great. Yeah. But go back to the pay thing. You're saying you're pushing back against that because beginning teachers are saying that they're getting low pay.
Beginning teachers saying they're getting low pay. Sure, absolutely. That's a common thing. I give presentations about becoming teachers pretty regularly out inside the community. And when I do, I always start with asking, where are the teachers in the room? Because I want to know where the potential rocks are going to be thrown from when I say this. The first thing is, a teacher's contract is 185 days generally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's 365 days out of the year. Okay. Now, any beginning teacher, they're working way more than that. I often tell beginning teachers, though, I say, get some experience, get a few years under your belt, have some good time management practices, and be organized, and you'll never have to work a major holiday or a weekend,
mm-hmm.
and you'll still have big sections of time off. And when you're pulling in $50,000 plus a pretty decent retirement package and some good health benefits, it's not a bad gig.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ask the accountant in April how they feel about their paycheck.
Right.
They don't really care. They may be making twice as much as you are, but they're driving themselves mad
mm-hmm.
getting there. Do you really want to do that? So
yeah, it's just like anything else. You need to put in some reps to get good at it.
Right.
And then you're in demand.
Mm-hmm.
And then just like anything else, you're climbing the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get promoted. You'll probably get to pick the, I don't know, the grade or the curriculum you want or something
sure.
like that. Or the school, even perhaps the school that you
yeah.
want to teach in.
Yeah. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, with the shortage of teachers, there's a chance for you to kind of negotiate things that you couldn't in years past.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
So at Ivy Tech, we talk a lot about our mission predominantly is an economic mission. We're trying to help people move into that middle class space.
Mm-hmm.
And I often tell people that if you go into teaching, you can have a good home and a nice Honda Accord.
It's okay. Great.
Which, nothing wrong with a Honda Accord.
No.
Of course, I've had some people say, what are you saying about Honda Accords?
I've had them.
Yeah, they're great.
One, yeah.
You're not going to drive a Maserati, okay, yeah. as a teacher probably. but yeah, you have a stable life. And I was just reading an article the other day that the biggest group of millionaires who are retired are actually teachers.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, it's a combination of things, right? They've kind of lived a frugal lifestyle probably for most of their life.
Sure.
They're good at saving and that kind of stuff.
And they're smart.
And they're, yeah, they're just they're making wise choices from the beginning of their career, which is great.
I love what you guys are doing at Ivy Tech. I think I told you that I taught there for a semester.
You did, yeah.
Or an abbreviated semester.
Okay.
In one of the programs. And it was just so much fun because I had a little bit different experience. I went to a private college
mm-hmm.
and then graduate school at a public university. And I remember sitting in this banquet that they had at the end, and there was a guest speaker. I forget who he was. He was doing a great job. He gave an excellent speech at this closing ceremony of the semester. And all my students are kind of scattered around this auditorium, you know, or eating dessert or something. And I remember the keynote speaker, said something along the lines of, I know many of you in here have dreams one day to take this degree and go on and become a, and he kind of stuttered a little bit at this point, and he said the word surgeon. And so I thought, oh, that's cool. Some of my students might become surgeons. But then he got caught up to what he was going to say, and he said, some of you are going to go on and become surgeon techs, mm-hmm. right? And so as I was processing that in a split second,
mm-hmm.
I went from thinking, oh, that's cool. Some of these guys are going to grow up or go on to become surgeons,
right.
to thinking, why do I think it's not cool that they're going to go on to become surgeon techs? That's awesome. We need just as many surgeon techs, right?
Right.
But it was so when you're talking about trying to get people from an economic mission, trying to get people from where they are moved up to the middle class,
mm-hmm.
that was neat to be involved in that environment because I got to see people hopefully help a few students in that same mission move up from perhaps a lower income environment to a middle class environment. And I just remember being caught off guard because he said surgeon tech. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's a good thing.
It is.
That's a very good thing. And shame on me for ever thinking like, oh, it's either surgeon or nothing.
Right.
Right. So that was cool. A cool experience. And, you know, I believe in that same mission. I think that's pretty cool. What are you mentioned a host of issues.
Hmm.
there. You know, you talked about gender identity and LGBTQ plus, and then helicopter parents and a few different things. I'm curious, we kind of zoom out a little bit, but so as a Christian in that space, let's just talk about the field itself. How have you noticed it change, you know, from your perspective as a Christian educator?
Yeah, well, and it's my journey. It's hard to take the Christian perspective and not also take another perspective. I mentioned at the beginning that I was an elementary school teacher. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't mention is I was an elementary school teacher who was a single male, mm-hmm. right? But you fast forward almost 20 years and I'm not a single male. I'm married. I have four children, all of which are older than some of the children I even taught when I was a teacher. Mm-hmm. So, there's an internal battle in my head on a daily basis in this space, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's what I think good teachers should do and could do. Mm-hmm. And then there's things that I don't necessarily want those teachers to do as a parent, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the challenges is that I think we're seeing, and this is where we see a lot of the fights, is who's the gatekeeper of certain knowledge, mm-hmm. right? And this varies. So we send our you know, if you send your kids to a public school, private school, charter school, co-op, homeschool, whatever, the school setting at the basic stance, you're expecting them to cover reading, writing, arithmetic, right? Those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Depending on your worldview, whether you're Christian or anything else for mm-hmm. that matter, you might wonder, do I really want them talking about character education or sex education or morality or anything like this? Mm-hmm. We want them to teach them how to read, but we might be very cautious as to what you're teaching my children to read, right? This is the concern of any parent sending their kid to school, regardless of where you might be on, let's say, a political spectrum, mm-hmm. right? I've seen that change significantly. It also is felt more strongly when you go to urban centers. If you're in a rural homogenous community, the law may say one thing, but what's happening day to day in, you know, small town USA is may very much feel comfortable if you're a white, you know, heterosexual family, right? Mm-hmm. But if you move into a large urban center, the education experience may be very different there, and you may have a lot more questions, and you may feel a little more uncomfortable or a lot more uncomfortable mm-hmm. depending on what's going on there, right? Mm-hmm. So those are the challenges. That's the shift that people, I think, experience. I know I grew up in a small town in southern Illinois. We had 600 people in my town, right? You know, and then I've spent the last 20 years in, you know, Indianapolis, which I don't know what the population is, but quite a bit different.
It's more.
Yeah.
It's like, I think it's like 1.something million
yeah.
in the greater.
Yeah, when they count all like Marion County or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, right. Significantly different. Mm-hmm. But you've got a lot of teachers or teacher candidates, as we would say, who are going into those spaces. Some of them are coming through school like I did, right? Rural community coming to a larger town or city, going to school and then moving into. And the better paying jobs and the more prevalent jobs are going to be in urban centers. So there's that culture shock. Plus that added uncertainty.
How have you had to modulate, I don't know, yeah, I'm not going to say your opinions or anything, but like how have you had to change and adapt how you're approaching students in given the amount of things that have changed over the last decade, socially speaking?
Like, sure.
Are you more cautious? Are you more thoughtful? You know, whatever.
You know, the culture's changed. And I'm getting older. Mm-hmm. So those are two things.
Oh, you too?
Yeah, right? So, you know, when I started, I had more hair and it was brown. It's, yeah.
Lucky
I have
you.
Less of it and yeah. it's gray, right? So no offense. Sorry, Dave.
Yeah.
But, so one thing is when I, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. You know, I had a lot of head knowledge and I thought this is right. I also have a personality that says, these are the things that are right in my mind. These mm-hmm. are the things that are wrong. So I looked at the world very much as a black and white system. Mm-hmm. Scripturally, as a Christian, there's a host of things that fall into this is wrong category, right?
Sure.
It's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole bunch of other things that are kind of gray, mm-hmm. right? And as I get older, I start seeing the shades of gray. And also think about, although this might be theologically right, leading with truth isn't necessarily the best approach when you're trying to build connections with people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in the spring, I had a class of, let's say, 20 students. Nearly a third of them, over the course of the eight-week class session that mm-hmm. we had, 2 months that we met together, I found out about a third of them kind of identified with the LGBTQ plus community.
Okay.
Okay. So I could have started my first class session saying, I'm a Christian and these are the views I hold and blah, blah, you know, and just kind of laid it all out there and said,
right.
And chances are I would have probably isolated the entire class, not just that one third. Right. Oh gosh, who's this? Mm-hmm. Here we got a zealot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I probably would probably gotten reprimanded. Like, why is that really relevant for an intro to teaching class?
Sure.
Which I would probably argue. Yeah. I don't think that was relevant. Right. However, as the semester continues, I do take moments where I pull back layers, usually to help them understand their own biases,
mm-hmm.
And to showcase what that means. Right. So, how I do that is I lead with grace generally. I do a lot of asking of questions, mm-hmm. listening and those kind of things, and then trying to some extent be a bit of a devil's advocate, right? If somebody's over here and saying, I think this is what education should look like, right? And we're going to fight against non-traditional home values, for mm-hmm. example, right? That comes up sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make sure my children see same-sex families in the literature I show and those kind of things. Okay, if that's your position, so be it. What do you do with a child or a family who doesn't hold that view? Okay. And then of course we can flip that back, right? If we go and say, what if you show that? And how do we work through that? And, and it gets complicated quickly, as mm-hmm. you can imagine. But one of the things I bring that up is because I go back to who's the gatekeepers of knowledge. Why I don't necessarily expect them to hold my view at the end, but I hope that they understand the other point.
So how did that class go? I mean, it started off,
yeah,
you know, you're teaching them.
Yeah.
By the end, what was the result?
It was great. Well, first of all, I had a particular student who identified as transgender. Okay. So the student had a name, a female name, was a female, and then kind of had what I would call probably a gender neutral name,
mm-hmm.
right? And asked me at the beginning of class, hey, on your roster, it's going to say this name. I go by this name. It was a gender neutral name. Some of you listening to this may disagree with this approach, but I said gender neutral, I don't really care. Okay.
Sure.
And so the pronoun thing's a different thing, but the actual name, do you want to go by, you know, if you want to go by, you know, I don't know, some cool rap name or something, Dave, you know,
that's me.
Yeah. Right.
Very cool.
Great.
Rapper.
Okay. We can do that. I'm not going to get hung up on that. If it's going to help me build a relationship with you here temporarily in the short term, great.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I did that. Right. Yep. I said, first of all, the student had to come up to me and tell me that. That's already showing some vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm starting off with, hey, okay, great. Thanks for letting me know that. We get 6 weeks into an 8 week term, and I have been doing predominantly most of the teaching. Week six, I kind of flip the script and I say, you go and you find the content that you want us to talk about. Usually it's in current issues. I say, go out there, look at current issues in education, bring mm-hmm. them back to the class. Well, one third of the group was kind of identified with LGBTQ. It also coincided with some protests that were happening at the state legislature mm-hmm. that time. So everybody came with those kind of comments. And what we ended up having was this large dialogue where people were saying, I can't believe that a conservative state like Indiana is banning certain kind of curriculum or
books
or healthcare, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, how dare they? Right. And so what I tried to explain to him, so I gave him some literature that kind of showcased the socially conservative perspective there.
Mm-hmm.
And also tried to explain to him from a parent standpoint, right? Who is the gatekeeper of certain knowledge. I'm fine with you teaching my kid to read, but do I really want you to be the educator of sexuality? Is that really something that you as a teacher should have to put on? That's a burden. It's a burden for a parent.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a burden for anybody else who's going to do it. Is that really, the state might be arguing that maybe that's not a burden that you should have.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you may have a different opinion on that. People listening to this may have a different opinion on that, but at least they gave him a chance to think, oh, okay, because I hold this opinion, that means I automatically assume I should take on the burden also.
Mm.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a shared perspective mm-hmm. or opinion. And so we spent a lot of time developing our philosophies of education there, and that lesson gave him a chance to think, oh, I may disagree with you, but you're holding to what you believe are true values, and I'm holding to some different values. I can respect that we have a different set of values. Mm-hmm. And that's where we landed, right?
Yeah.
And that I'm okay with that, especially in, this is an introduction course. This is their first semester in college, mm-hmm. and this is the kind of conversations we're having. So I'm okay with that being where they land.
I think that's huge. I mean, you moved a needle in their minds, not necessarily in towards a position,
yeah,
but towards thinking.
Right.
And that's a big deal. You know, and I think so. That we tend to argue for positions instead of trying to train thinkers,
right.
trying to create or to build thinkers, which leads me to a question. I was thinking about this, like, what do you see your role as a professor in building good citizens for society? Like, I think that you are shaping people every day.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know, maybe not on committee meeting days, I don't know, but but you're shaping future citizens, right?
Sure.
And how do you go about doing that, and is that a burden to bear, or are you excited about that?
Well, first I got to ask you the question, a follow-up question. What are you saying is a good citizen? I mean, that's pretty open.
Yeah. Yeah, sure it is. So I think that...
Are you wanting me to walk away so they're paying their taxes and obeying the speed limit? Then the burden's not very heavy.
Yeah, no, it's not.
Because I don't teach taxes and I don't teach driving. So,
yeah, I think what I'm thinking about is morally upstanding citizens have a certain moral code.
Hmm.
And I know that moral code is debated, but there's certain things about I don't steal, I don't murder, various other things that are commonly agreed on.
Mm-hmm.
And that commonly agreed moral code, I think, is getting reduced more and more in society.
Okay.
And what it sounded like you were talking about just a few seconds ago was that you move the needle towards creating someone or building up someone's thinking abilities towards a goal of some kind.
Yes.
That's what I'm asking.
Sure.
Like, why are you doing that? What direction does that go?
Right. So one is this, I have a central tenet, so I don't always show my whole hand to my students.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because if I do, then they're just going to, they have the potential just to repeat back to me what I want to hear, mm-hmm. which I'm not interested in. There's a chance that I could also maybe get in trouble if I say, this is what I think everybody should be believing, right? I could get in trouble for that if it goes into a religious area, and it's likely to with the worldview I hold. So I think that puts me in, and I just don't think that's necessary at this stage in their educational journey.
Okay.
Again, we're talking about an introduction course here.
Mm-hmm.
So to the question, the first thing it's probably one of the things I get most excited about. I used to have a name tag when I first started at the college. I've been at the college for over 14 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have a name tag that said, changing lives, making Indiana great. It was a marketing thing,
yeah.
But we loved it. Most of us kind of who came in at that time loved that because we really kind of felt that way. Certainly an extension of my own personal mission of like, why do you know, we think about vocation, right? From a, from a religious lens, right? I mean, for many years I've felt called to do the kind of work that I've done. So when I sit and I do a seminar on diversity, equity, and belonging, which I do, and I'm aware that I'm a white guy doing that. And
the irony is not lost on you.
Yeah, right. And I highlight that. But, you know, we do an activity where we're trying to explain bias. So I share an activity with them and I say, hey, here's this scenario. We've got four candidates with some things that you've learned about them. And it goes something like this. You know, I need you to pick one of the candidates to be the next, primary grade urban elementary teacher for the school setting. So primary grades, usually kindergarten through third grade, and urban, right? Okay, so high poverty areas generally, and those kind of things. And so again, here's person A. He drives a big truck, listens to country music. He's a hunter. You know, he's kind of direct personality. And there you go. Person B drives a minivan, got a bunch of kids, sings, kind of religious, you know, that's kind of thing. C's like rides their bike to work, listens to pop music, into gardening and, you know, gluten-free.
Coffee shops.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. And
non-celiac gluten-free, like yeah, personality yeah, type yeah. of gluten-free.
No, I mean, they can be celiac.
Okay.
And then D is, you know, this, you know, bourbon drinking, you know, guy with a bunch of degree. I didn't say guy, but a person with a bunch of, you know, academic degrees. Mm-hmm. Who's the best pick? And what they do is they start picking apart and all, you know, and essentially if all those four people were standing in there, the class inevitably tears them apart and offends them significantly. Mm-hmm. And I flipped the script a little bit and I said, this is great. I love it. Thanks for being honest. I actually invited all four of those people here. They're going to come in here in just a minute and you can, you know, kind of, they can watch your face get red. Mm-hmm. What I don't tell them is, so I walk out in the room and I, you know, kind of do this little theatric thing and I walk back in and I say, ta-da, here they are.
Ah.
Because all four of them are just different variations of me.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. I'm gluten-free. I try my hand at gardening. I mm-hmm. like to sing, but I don't know that I'm any good at it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I have degrees. I like to go out hunting. All these are just attributes of me. So they've offended me multiple ways. Mm. But what I try to highlight for them is the fact that they had biases depending on their backgrounds. Now, some of them like the hunter dude because that's their background, right? Mm. And they're like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's me. And I think, you know, others are over here are like, oh, that's a redneck hillbilly. He's racist and whatever, right? And you've got somebody over here who's, you know, person B's the religious zealot. And they're like, well, they're going to be over there telling everybody about Jesus all the time in class and get themselves fired or confuse the students or something. And person C is a tree-hugging hippie, you know, and person D's this old professor dude, right?
Yeah.
But what it does is it highlights, because they inevitably never know it's me, or sometimes they think one of them's me or something. Mm-hmm. They're grossly embarrassed, but they recognize they had some biases. And mm-hmm. I tell them, it's okay. I have them too. When I see a group of people that are sometimes even one of these categories, even though I'm a part of that to some degree, I think, oh gosh, I should probably watch what I say with that group. Mm-hmm. You know, understanding your bias is the first step of just understanding, hey, this is okay. Okay.
Like, I think that gets really at the nub of the question about forming good citizens, because I think being able to think critically is what it takes, at least a bedrock for being a good citizen. I think so. Showing them that they have biases is really important.
Right.
And I think that was actually, in a strange way, I had been a Christian for a number of years, but then when I first got into Reformed theology, it was revealing my biases that I had. And I'm like, oh, man, I believe this because of this and this. And that. And then I started thinking, right? And I could regurgitate a lot of things before then, but then I started thinking and realizing, oh, wow, I have a lot of biases that are pointing me in one direction or this direction, whatever. So yeah, I think that gets at the question, because at its core, at least in its best scenario, the state believes in education because it is trying to form good citizens that are healthy citizens. Now, that definition varies, but I think that's what I'm trying to get at, because the state takes its goal, rightly or wrongly, depending on your opinion, that they're trying to make citizens that are worthwhile citizens that will help further society. And I think that peeling back someone's eyelids to see some biases is super important.
Yeah, because, I mean, the college at least the community college generally is an economic workforce engine. So when we talk about, from a state's perspective, the reason the state supports and generally likes what we're doing at Ivy Tech Community College is we're trying to basically increase the taxpayer group, right?
Sure.
And from an economic lens, that's great.
Yeah.
Right? And Christians can usually get behind that too, right? We know that just financial stability by itself isn't really going to change someone's heart. But we know that Jesus cares about financial stability just like they care about the heart too, right?
Yep.
So from that standpoint, I take it a step further by saying, okay, I can train you to be a teacher in mediocrity, or I can teach you to be a great teacher, because the reality is you're going to walk into a classroom one day. If you walked into one like I did from rural Southern Illinois, I couldn't pronounce most of my students' names, okay, because they were just names that weren't common to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, they weren't Chris, Steve, and Andrew, right? And so there's a lot of different, we only had one race in my neighborhood, you know, in my town, and it was white. And so if you're in any other race, there's a lot of different namings that happen, right? Read the Bible and we see some good examples of names we can't hardly pronounce. Mm-hmm. So, but understand that you're going to walk into a classroom one day and there's going to be a whole group of people who probably don't look like you, think like you, have the experiences you've had, and they're going to have biases against you. And then if you're not careful, you're going to have them against them, or you're going to have them against them. But if you're not careful, you're not even going to recognize those biases. And then you're going to act in an inappropriate way that's going to marginalize both of you and make your education ineffective.
Mm-hmm. I think this discussion about biases is super interesting and important because as a Christian, most of my interactions with people that aren't Christians, I'm trying to go the extra mile by understanding my own biases, but then also kind of listening for theirs. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's kind of what makes for a profitable conversation.
Yeah.
Genuine friendship and perhaps the opportunity to tell them what I believe about Jesus.
Right.
By understanding and listening. Right. And I think even if it's not religion, our society has lost a lot of that listening ability. It's just all, it's all yelling instead of listening. Right?
True.
I wanted to ask a question. I kind of wanted to go back to something you said about as a economic engine. Is that what you said?
Economic workforce.
Economic engine. Workforce engine. Does it concern you that many people are going to college just because they're told they're supposed to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Taking on hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt.
It's a shame.
Getting a degree in 18th century French history, art history or something.
Yeah.
And then coming out and not being able to find a job.
Right.
I would say probably not being a very good citizen. Like, I sense that we're starting to pull back from that slightly, but I still hear a lot, you know, I'm in my 40s, so I see a lot of kids just going into colleges and getting lots of debt and majoring in things that are relatively useless. And I say this as someone with two music degrees, right?
Still waiting for that platinum album?
Still waiting for the platinum, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, as an educator, what are your thoughts on this? Like, does it bother you that this is the trend in college? Like, people are going to get these degrees, hundreds of, I mean, people are graduating college with a house, with the cost of a house in debt.
Right, right.
Does it?
It bothers me significantly. Mm-hmm. It's probably one of the challenges when, you know, on a bad day, and I don't want to work at Ivy Tech anymore.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to go work at College X instead. That's probably one of the things that causes me to pause.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that. I also have been around college students for a long time now, and I recognize that some of that is self-induced. Not all of it, but some of it.
Sure.
For years, I don't know what the current research says, but the average student who starts college and ends with their bachelor's degrees changed their major 6 times. Okay? I mean, that's just, if you're over there talking about, French, 18th century French literature, and you decide to go over to psychology, not a lot of those credits are going to overlap, right?
No.
One, English comp, maybe speech, right? That's it. So you've still got 120 credits to figure out, or 117 to go, right? So one thing that I hate is that we don't help people think about what's next.
Mm-hmm.
We also have kind of these, complexes in our head that we think we're supposed to know everything right at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so there's an opportunity where we talk about this at the college a lot, is just helping people understand what should they be going into. So there's some great ways to do that. What I love about community college, I would think that's why community college is growing, even, or it can grow in a national scale. It's taken a hit. All higher ed has taken a hit, but you see community colleges starting to grow a little bit and bounce back a little bit faster sometimes. And this is because they're making education affordable. You know, I have students now that come to Ivy Tech, get their associate's degree, transfer on to even private schools,
mm-hmm.
and go on and get master's degree. I actually worked and did some negotiations for this agreement we have. We have students who would start from the beginning and leave at the end with a master's degree, and they would net $10,000 in 5 years.
Incredible.
Right? So that's flipping the script quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. Now, is everybody getting to do that? No. But I do think, one, kids, I get it. And I had this experience. Maybe you did too. You wanted to move out, go into the dorm, have that life and whatever. There's a cost with that. And a lot of students can't go through that experience. I appreciate higher ed, and I understand there's a lot of benefits to going and living in a dorm and building those communities and those kind of things. But it's kind of cost benefit analysis. Like, if you can afford to have that experience, great. But there's a point where you got to ask yourself, are those experiences worth the house payment at the end?
Right.
And as a fiscally conservative guy, I'm going to say no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I come out the same place there. And I also think that part of the problem is that we expect kids now to have a master's because the master's is the new whatever. It's the new college education, right? I mean, if you don't have that, oh, you'll never get a job if you don't have a master's. And eventually, I mean, we're probably already there, but you're never going to get that job if you don't have a PhD, right? So it's just, it keeps getting, which then degrades the degrees themselves. And it's just a
Well, you also got to think about what kind of jobs are out there and what is you as an individual's goal? Are you trying to have this like existential experience? Like everybody wants to, you know, when I go around and say I'm a professor, right? That kind of puts you in some sort of status. Mm-hmm. But if
like
I showed up,
a smoking jacket and a pipe,
right?
Status.
But if I showed up today at this podcast and said, "Hey, I'm Andrew Buckle, the plumber," okay, what you may not know is a person who's good at plumbing and owns their own business is financially running circles around the professor,
right?
Right. And so, if the goal is to be financially secure, then college may not be the best choice for you.
I actually do know that because as a musician with 2 degrees, I spent time as a plumber.
So, right.
I'm a mediocre musician. What are you going to do? You're going to end up plumbing.
But and
he was rich. I was broke.
So
he never went to college.
So, you know, I've met masons, I've met framers, I've met drywallers, I've met, you know, the whole trades group. And I look at them sometimes in jealousy, right? Mm-hmm. They've got their own schedules, their own work plan, they're their own bosses. They all seem to be making pretty good livings. Now there is that fear of when's the river going to dry up for me type of feel.
Right.
But I still applaud that. And that doesn't necessarily require college education. Now I work in the liberal arts school at my college. So if we don't talk about like, well, you know, everybody taking a history class and an English class, a science class and a, you know, literature class, there's some benefit to that. I agree with it. But again, and I think everybody can benefit from taking those classes and having those experiences, but not at, you know, if it's going to put them again at a house payment at the end.
Right.
And so I think everybody should have a shot at that. And I think there's some value in that, but I don't know how many plumbers care about taking creative writing. So
no, I joke with people that when I got done with my degree in music, what I bought with that money was I was interesting at parties. That's basically it. I didn't have a good job. I was still working, as a plumber or Panera or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I paid for an education to become mildly interesting, and that's debatable if I'm even mildly interesting. Anyway,
I mean, but I hang out with you outside of this setting, and I would call you an interesting guy.
Okay, thank you.
So it paid off.
Okay, good. Woo! Glad for the $100,000 to be interesting. You mentioned something else, though, when you're talking about the trades. This is another kind of hobby horse of mine. We see the decline of the useful arts in society. Like, shop class is kind of no longer in high schools, right? I mean, it's some, but not. It's losing funding, et cetera. Probably not. And I don't know how it is at Ivy Tech, but do you guys have trade school?
Yeah. So we actually started. We're unique than any other college because we kind of do two things that other colleges only do one in. So you have trade schools, right?
Right.
Like you can go to like the apprenticeship to be an electrician or something.
Yeah.
We have like kind of equivalent. You want to go into mechanics, you want to go into any of these trades that we're talking about, we have a pathway for you.
Okay, cool.
And it's usually cheaper than the trade schools that are, that's the only thing they do.
Yeah, I love that.
So we're kind of a secret we don't want to be secretive about, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to go and become a diesel mechanic, you can go to like Lincoln Tech where you see these cool, and you can get a cool like $10,000 Snap-on tool chest when you graduate.
Right, yeah.
But it's going to cost you $70,000 or something.
Right.
You can do the same thing. You won't get the $10,000 tool chest, but you will be at max out of debt $10,000.
Yeah.
And you have a job to pay you $60,000 to $80,000.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good trade-off.
You can buy the whole Snap-on truck at that point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and we have lots of areas that follow that. And then we also have the liberal arts, you know.
Okay.
We don't have a music degree necessarily, but we have art program, right? Mm-hmm. We have an education program. We have an English program, you know, and math program and those kind of things that are meant to transfer onto those bachelor's degrees and then move on from there. We have a psychology program, for example. So we have kind of both. You know, the IU system's not trying to get diesel mechanics, right? They're just trying to get your English classes, you know, all those liberal arts, humanities kind of programs and business and so forth.
Forming interesting people.
Sure, yeah. So we kind of sit in both spots.
Yeah, I love that. For
a fraction of the cost.
That's cool. One of the things that I loved when I was teaching at Ivy Tech was the building I was in, and it might be your building, I don't know, but I was at the fourth floor of a building, and on the first floor was where all of the cooking classes took place.
Okay.
And so they had a cafe, and they sold all of the baked goods, right? So before I would go up to class or afterwards when I was grading papers or whatever,
sure,
I'd be like buying all these baked goods at the super cheap cost.
Yeah.
And it was so good. I'm just like, this is like the dream come true. I'm like sitting here reading, doing whatever, and buying baked goods that were just made. And I thought it was so cool because I love seeing these you know, new bakers get all in, dressed up in their jackets and I don't know what they're called and everything, the toques or whatever.
Sure.
And getting all nervous about, you know, I got a presentation on brownies today. You know, it's just, it was so far out of my field. I loved watching it. I thought it was super cool. And they did a great job. I mean,
it's
the food,
impressive.
The food was so good.
Yeah.
And in fact, we even employ a grad from Ivy Tech chef school here at the church.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
So, that's, yeah, it's, I love the program that you guys, what you guys are doing there. I'm curious, all teachers have good stories because things happen. Like, what funny things, what interesting things have happened to you as a teacher in the classroom?
Besides kindergarten.
Like, I'm,
yeah,
I'm assuming
I had
everyone, you know,
stories.
Wets their pants and everything.
Yeah, I had better stories when I taught kindergarten than when I do in, as a college professor. I think some of the ones are just kind of sad to hear. You know, you got a parent and a student coming in and they're complaining about their grade or something, and mom's in the corner like, you know, how dare you, Dr. Buckle, not grade this, not do that. And then you're like, well, here's the email correspondence that you're, you know, your child didn't tell you. And to watch the tables turn, they're like, oh, I came to advocate for my child. Now I'm over here on your team. And then there's the other times where you present all the evidence and be like, your child's had lots of opportunities. And then be like, where's the next opportunity? And continue to stay. So that's always kind of surprising. Gosh, you're catching me off guard for a good story.
The helicopter parents, those are the ones that interest me, I think, because I remember one of my first jobs out of college and during grad school was working in a college dorm, and we had lots of helicopter parents that had a lot of opinions about who their kids' roommates were and all of these things, and I had to field all these things, and I'm like, man, I would be so embarrassed if my parents ever did this, you know, to call a college official and said, I want this right now, you know.
Yeah.
Parents to me are the...
Most of the things are kind
ones.
Of, yeah, the, most of the interesting ones are kind of like you had to be there type of thing. You get students who, you know, just social skills are lacking, and they're just really awkward in class. And
I had plenty of those in the music department, don't worry.
Yeah, right. And so you get folks who are always sitting there and kind of doing things, and you're like, that's...
Maybe not the place to be
this
doing
is
that.
Not the place to do that. And you have these weird and awkward conversations afterwards.
But yeah.
Most of the ones that are entertaining, at least for academics, is, you know, when you catch somebody plagiarizing, but then they, you know, they think that this is their story. And you're like, so this is your paper? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, I worked really hard on it. And I'm like, then can you explain why this one exists, right? Because this was written.
Give me the provenance.
This one
of
was
this
written in
one.
September 19th, but here's another one with a different person's name that I found on the World Wide Web that was written in August, you know, or, you know, March 30th. And they're like, you know, you can just see the temperature rise.
Yeah.
And
I wrote that one then too.
Yeah. You switched from Jeff to Angie because, you know, but I don't see that.
Yeah, I don't
so,
see it.
So those are, you know, kind of catching students. Those are the ones that are somewhat entertaining, but they're probably not entertaining to the larger public. Now, as a kindergarten teacher, there were some more that were probably more entertaining. You know, I was really like, if you ever watched Kindergarten Cop, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah.
Like I like
nobody has a tumor.
Yeah, right.
I remember that. Yeah.
I like watched that in preparation for each year I taught kindergarten, and you know I was all about like processes. There was a guy who kind of said, "Hey, if you want to be good in the education space, like get good, just have a process for kids." And so I had kids like, "Hey, when we're walking down the hallway, we got to be quiet and straight line." Mm-hmm. And so we just practiced a lot. But apparently, I had like a kid who was probably a little socially awkward, like take me seriously, and so like he walked out of a shoe. So his shoe came untied. He's a kindergarten. He walks. He goes down all the way the hallway. Another teacher's like, somebody loses a shoe. But I've like instilled in them, like, you don't talk in the hallway. We keep our eyes forward. We keep moving. You know, we're not going to be a circus. And, you know, I get to class and he's like over there with his shoe off. I'm like, you didn't think that it was appropriate to stop and grab your shoe? And he's like, No,
that's
I can't. You told me not to stop.
Hey, he obeyed the rule, though. I mean,
he did.
Talk
I
about
mean,
forming good citizens.
Oh, yeah,
maybe down the road,
he
could be governor. That'd be great.
He's going to be a good citizen. So he may not be clothed all the time, but, you know, he'll be a good citizen.
That's awesome. Well, I love the work that you're doing. I think it's super important. Keep it up. And, I look forward to hearing great things about Ivy Tech.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Dave,
for being here.
Yep.
Maine and Gray is brought to you by Christ Community Church of Carmel, Indiana. at the corner of Main Street and Gray Road. If you're looking for a church home or just visiting the Indianapolis area, stop in and say hi. We'd love to get to know you. Until then, God bless.